Now it's time to Pop Off with Mary Jane Pop.
So would you believe Walt Disney actually shaped generations of Americans? Well, Dr. John West says absolutely. His influence went from Spielberg to Lucas and culture in general. Well, filmmaker and author of Walt Disney and Live Action, Dr. John West goes into detail on family morals, government, and freedom for that matter. And John is a documentary filmmaker, so he knows of what he speaks. Dr. West, nice to have you with us on the show.
Mary Jane, delighted to be here.
Okay, let's talk about this. Was it Walt Disney's intent to really deliver a message, or was it just incidental?
Well, that's a great question. I think he said people made the types of films that they wanted to see, and I think that certainly was true with him. And so I think not so much incidental. I think it was baked into it because, again, he made the things he was passionate about, and so his own convictions and principles couldn't help but bleed into things. So I don't think that, for the most part, he said, well, I want to make this message, and then we're going to make this message film. It was more that the things that he loved the most organically came out, and his worldview was sort of expressed, just like I said, baked into the cookie, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you don't find that anymore. It's almost like, I shouldn't say that. There are some people that really still have that passion, and they'll do only projects that are very passionate for them. But with Disney, it seemed like that was his whole life, his whole mission.
That is one of the things that drove him. And he always wanted to find a new hill to climb. And so one of the amazing things about Disney is that, people think of him as animated films. Then there was a theme park. And my book is about his live action efforts, not just film, but also TV. He was really an early pioneer of high quality television productions. And, he always wanted to do something new. And so I think that also drove him and is why he was so multi-talented. But you're right. I think many, though, of the people who change our culture or are foundational, they do things out of their passion. And mm-hmm. That certainly was right with Disney.
Then he actually, you said, went after America's challenges, from civil rights to civil disobedience, family disintegration, immigration, big business, big government. I mean, he went after all of these issues, didn't he?
It is really interesting because most people, I think, Disney films, especially the live action, but also the animated, that's just pablum for, children. Actually, Disney really got upset near the end of his life when everyone was saying, he makes children's films.
Yeah.
He said, I make films for the entire family. He didn't think of himself as just making children's films. And so you're right, all those topics. So just to talk about some specifics,
There
was this beautiful film in the 1950s, and it was during the early civil rights struggles, called Light in the Forest. Now, on the surface, it told this story about a white young man who was actually captured by the Indians and raised by them and then sent back to white society where he faced lots of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was set in the 1700s. But really, if you actually look at the context of when it was released, it was pretty clear that the message of racial tolerance and equality and against prejudice, that was what was being made. And it wasn't just applying to something in the 1700s. It was, applying to the struggles that were happening right then and there. On Family Breakdown, something like Mary Poppins, this wonderful, wonderful film. But I didn't realize, actually, until talking to the Sherman brothers, now one of them is actually deceased, but Richard Sherman is still there, just how much, family and, the two-career family, where both parents are so involved in their work and their other projects that that kids just get short shrift, how central that is to that film. If you think about it, Mary Poppins goes there. Her function, actually, is to make it so she can leave, so that she brings the children with the parents back together again.
Yeah.
And, they set the film back in the Edwardian era, so it seemed to be, this not here and now. But think about it. The dad is so enmeshed in his banking, in his corporate climbing, that he has no time even to do a kite with his children.
Mm.
The mom is so enmeshed in her political activities for equal rights for women, which is perfectly fine, but she had no time for her kids. So both parents, this really was not the picture of parents in the early 1900s.
Dysfunctional family was what it was. Right?
In the 1960s and beyond.
Wow.
And then at the end of it, how they reconcile with the dad, of course, it's really apparent that he goes and flies the kite. What I didn't notice until the Sherman brothers pointed out to me is that, well, who provides the tail to the kite? Well, it's the mom, and it's actually from her protest. You know, it's the banner that she wore for her protest. Now, this doesn't mean she won't protest anymore, but it meant that she was recognizing that she, too, you know, had to nurture her kids. It wasn't just the dad, and they couldn't just do it with the British version of daycare, a nanny.
How subtle. I mean, it was little subtle things like that, you know, like the banner.
Yeah, and then, you know, big business and stuff. You know, Disney was sort of very free market oriented, very much his own man, and so he didn't like government that was really officious and getting involved. If you watch both The Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber, two films of Fred McMurray, these wonderful fantasy comedies that were actually, I think, both in the top 10 films in the year that they were released as far as highest grossing, they're phenomenally popular even today on DVD and online. Well, the portrait that they give of the Pentagon and of the IRS, I mean, they just poke fun at these sort of officious government bureaucrats. And, you know, that also came from Disney's heart. But then on immigration, you notice, this is a film that most people sort of ignore, don't know about. It was done after Disney died, called The Happiest Millionaire. And it is a big musical. And at the time, they were doing all these big screen musicals. And it's not the best film that he ever did, although there are lots of fun parts of it. But it tells the story, in part, of an immigrant from Ireland. And this is in the early 1900s when the Irish got a lot of discrimination in America against them.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes and becomes a butler to this sort of blue-blooded American millionaire's family. And but part of it is about how America ought to be welcoming to that, and they have the industrialist played by Fred McMurray basically saying, are you going to become an American citizen, and you know, you should be proud of being American? And so that was part of it. But the butler makes the point that in America, and there's this wonderful song, I'll Always Be Irish, that America, unlike most countries of the world, our citizenship is not based on our race or culture or religion. It's based that we accept the basic creed of that all men are created equal, and that we have basic inalienable rights, and that anyone who agrees with that, you can be an American citizen, no matter what your race, ethnicity. And so the song, written by the Sherman Brothers again, I'll Always Be Irish, talks about how, in the case of Ireland, how much of Irish culture was still in America. You could still be a good Irish and a good American.
Fantastic.
And now, so, you know, that has broader, you know,
implications, so, yeah. He was an incredible man, let's put it that way. But how much of Disney is his personal side is known as opposed to, you know, the persona that he had as Walt Disney in quotes?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there are two different things that people think they know about them. You know, Disney himself was a very public persona, and so he was introducing his TV show each week, and so people got the idea of sort of Uncle Walt, this very kindly man, which he actually was in many ways. And then sort of there's been a cottage industry in the last two decades of trying to throw dirt on him. Oh, actually, he was anti-Semitic, he was this, he was that. And I think neither really tell you about, you know, who he was. I interviewed about two dozen people who worked closely with him. Many of them now have died, but it was just a wonderful thing talking to them. And, you know, Disney was remarkably creative. You know, he could be a bull in a china shop because he was so exciting, but he did have a deep compassion for people, too. And one of the stories that I was told, that I think I was the first one to ever hear the story, it was with Emile Curie, was this award-winning set decorator. He worked for Frank Capra on It's a Wonderful Life. He worked for Hitchcock. And then he went to work for Disney. I think it was actually first on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where I think he won an Academy Award for the set decorations. And then he stayed with Disney. He himself, and this is actually interesting, was of Lebanese extraction, and so he was from the Middle East. That was his ethnicity. And he and Disney actually formed a close personal friendship. So one day they were visiting together Disneyland. He'd go with Disney. You know, Disney would like to go to Disneyland and just walk up, and when he wasn't mobbed, just observe how people were, you know, looking at things. And on that particular day, he saw Disney was sort of watching people come in to the park. There were like a couple of nuns and something like 15 to 20 orphans. that were that they were from their school that was, I think they were holding each other's hand or something because they had all to go together. And Disney was just amazed, wow, they're all coming here, and how could they even afford that? And so he basically went up and he refunded their money and said, enjoy yourself.
Nice.
And there was another case where, I want to think school kids, there was like a story where their bus had broken down, and then they finally got there, and he decided to just give them lunch on him. And so, you know, there was a really, Disney did like to surprise people. He did like to do nice things for them, and he loved his family. I mean, unlike most people in Hollywood, his family, his wife, his two daughters were fiercely protective of him and his image. They loved their dad. There were no, you know, nasty tell-alls after he died. I mean, they just loved him.
Amazing. Now, you mentioned in your book about the filmmakers of today that he influenced. Did he influence because of the technology or that passion that we've been talking about?
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit of both. So let's take Steven Spielberg, who once said that in every film he made, he would ask the question, would Walt Disney like this? I don't
really
know if he still does that, but that's what he said in the 1980s and 90s. If you look at Spielberg, he's one of the things he's known is for great visuals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is he's just an outstanding director, but he knows that film is different than a stage play, is different than a book, and it's just stunning visuals. Well, I think that's one of the things he got from Disney. Disney was lucky to be trained as an artist, and then the animated films trained him that even in live action, these stunning visuals, whether it be the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or a basketball game played on air in The Son of Flub, Absent-Minded Professor, or if anyone has seen Darby O'Gill and The Little People, if they haven't, they need to go out and see it, this fantasy set in, you know, Ireland with leprechauns and everything, with these stunning scenes, they're just massive soundstage scenes, just stunning visuals, even today. I mean, actually, the interesting thing about Disney special effects, you can still watch 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or Darby O'Gill, and their special effects still
hold up.
And you,
wow.
I mean, I cannot think of some other films from the 1950s, especially fantasy or fantasy science fiction, that do that. So Spielberg, I think, got some of that visual thought from him. And actually, just one technical thing in filmmaking that Disney wasn't the first one to do, but really helped pioneer, and that was storyboarding.
Oh, yeah.
And so what they would do is they did the script, but then they would plan out, you know, scene by scene, and they'd have an artist of how they wanted it to look, what perspective they wanted the camera. This would actually help tell him what parts of the sets they needed to build and what not, so it was a good cost-effective. But it was also, it allowed him to, you know, exercise more control over, you know, what was in the film. Spielberg and Lucas both, but especially Spielberg, I know, has used storyboards, you know, extensively, and I think, you know, that's another contribution from Disney.
Well, and look at what Lucas has done, and you say he was a great influence on Lucas too, right?
Well, Lucas said when the original Star Wars came out in an interview with the LA Times that he thought that this was the type of film that Disney would have made while Walt Disney was alive. And I think that what you get from Lucas also and Spielberg, they're the moral core and a moral center to most of their films. They do not go over, you know, they don't believe in the age of the anti-hero or that, you know, that there is no right or wrong and that, you know, it's just all, everyone hates each other.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there is a moral core, and both of them have actually been attacked on. Oh, this is simplistic, good and evil. And that was something Disney was attacked on. And so I actually do think that, yeah, content-wise, there also is, you know, things that elevate human beings that call out the better angels of their nature, as Lincoln talked about, and that is also ties them together with Disney.
You know, it's amazing that filmmakers, and I'm not all filmmakers, but a lot of the filmmakers, they go after the salacious, the really weird stuff, and then somebody comes out with La La Land, and it's loved. Everybody loves it. It's like, hello, don't you get it? That you need some family movies that, you know, just maybe want to make you laugh or make you, you know, cry and laugh at the same time or just have a fun time. You know what I mean?
I think that's true, but I think Disney was, again, very perceptive. It was when he was asked a question precisely about what you're talking about. Why is Hollywood just making increasingly degradation movies and not, you know, why are they doing it? Is it because it sells? And actually, that's not true, really. The more general interest films actually can actually do phenomenally well.
Yeah.
And so Disney said, again, it was because Hollywood makes the type of films they want to see. And so it often reflects, it's not their commercial things, it reflects their own, unfortunately, messed up lives and worldview.
Yeah.
And that's out of which, you know, it's made. And that was Disney's point in the 60s, and I think there was a lot to be said for it.
What do you think he'd say about Hollywood today?
Well,
let me guess.
I mean, he was, you know, in the end, last, he died in 1966, and in the last few years of his life, there were strands in Hollywood that were getting very sort of anti-human and very focused on degradation. So he did comment on it, and he wasn't happy about it. And when people, I guess my favorite story, because it shows also, you know, he wasn't just namby-pamby. I mean, he really, there was a story at a dinner for the Academy Awards where he was just being mercilessly poked by his fellow producers about, you're just making this family-oriented stuff. This is just schlock. This is the, and he put down his fork and he looked over and said, "I'll put my Mary Poppins against your putrid pornographic and then an expletive any day."
No kidding. I love him. I wish I would have known somebody like someone like him, who had that passion, who, you know, was not knocked off track. Too many, I think, filmmakers maybe start out with that passion and then they get sidetracked because they just can't get anywhere with those movies. You know what I mean?
I think that's true. And like I said, I think one way he kept his passion was that he kept doing new things. And so at the end of his life, he was really into urban development and how you could make lives better for everyone. Now, he still was involved in his filmmaking and things, but I think having fresh challenges all the time helped keep all the stuff that he did new.
You said he was a hands-on guy. So, but he also depended on the people that worked for him. It was like a family, from what I understand.
It was. And he, it was amazing how the process they did for film. So, you know, he would have script writers and things, but they would then, he'd go through the scripts, and I actually saw some of these that he'd mark up, you know, just and add whole new scenes and sequences. Then he'd have a story conference where they'd go through every line, and sometimes he'd act out entirely new scenes.
Wow.
And he, and so, and then, talk about the family aspect. There was one film, That Darn Cat, which was Haley Mills, her last film for the studio under Walt. Fun, really nice, funny comedy based on a book by award-winning mystery writers. Anyway, for the gags in the film, they basically sent the script around to like 50 different people in the studio from office boys on up to ask, do you have ideas?
Mm.
And so he actually solicited ideas for the film from, you know, people from the lowest to the highest in the studio. So, you know, they would do summer stock plays in the studio where people could, you know, put on plays during the summer. It was a very family-friendly, very collegial, like a big family.
Amazing. What do you think he would say with, you know, the computer-generated stuff that's today? You know, they even replace people. I'm getting to a point where I think they're not going to need actors anymore. They can just computer-generate them.
Well, you know, he was an enthusiast for technology, and, of course, his use of robotics in Disneyland and Walt Disney World, audio animatronics. I actually think he would have been intrigued and loved that. But I think he also would have pointed out it really doesn't replace human beings because what you need even to create these scenes, they're not being created by computers. They're being created by artists and programmers and hundreds of people who actually build those things. I think, though, he probably also would have pined, you know, some of the 3D animation is a little bit sterile and so from an artistic standpoint, so I think that he probably would have wanted to find ways so that it wasn't just boilerplate, it looked the same, and but I think he would have been intrigued. I mean, he was one for, he pioneered, actually, the multiplane camera, which was an early way of giving depth to 2D cartoons.
Wow.
As if you were having, you know,
amazing.
Like 3Ds. And so he did like technology.
I think he also would find his own way. It would be the Disney way, which is fantastic. No, you have a website, right?
WaltDisneyAndLiveAction.com.
WaltDisneyAndLiveAction.com. And, of course, the book itself, Walt Disney and Live Action, available where?
At Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. And if you go to the website, WaltDisneyInLiveAction.com, there are links, too, to make it easy.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank you, as always, John, the best. Great information about Walt Disney and much more to come. And I hope you'll come back and visit with us again.
I'd love to. Thank you, Mary Jane.
You betcha. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That's WaltDisneyInLiveAction.com. That's the name of the book, Walt Disney in Live Action. It's the real story on Pop Off. In the meantime, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else, dare to dream. Remember, if you don't have the dream, how the heck are you going to make the dream come true? Talk with you next time on Pop Off.